Welcome to episode 38 of the Fredcast for the week of October the 2nd, 2006. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. Welcome back to the Fredcast. In this week's episode, we're going to have a brief look at the news. Then we're going to finish our interviews from my last day at the 2006 Interbike Expo in Las Vegas, Nevada. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Well, there's been another Pro Tour race since we last did the news here on the Fredcast, and this one was the Zuri Metzegete in Zurich, Switzerland. This one-day, 233-kilometer race featured some of the most famous names in the peloton and was won by Samuel Sanchez from Spain and the Euskaltel team, and he did it in 6 hours, 3 minutes, and 47 seconds. Second place went to Australia's Stuart O'Grady, 30 seconds behind Sanchez, and third went to David Rebellin of Italy. Now, this is Sanchez's first one-day win of his career, and he did it by breaking away from the lead group of riders with just 12 kilometers to go in the race. This was the third to last Pro Tour race for this season. There are just two more one-day races left. The first is coming up this weekend, October the 10th. It's Paris Tours, and then the final race of the season is the Giro di Lombardia, which takes place October the 14th. At that point, the Pro Tour will be done for 2006. Now, at this point, in the lead of the Pro Tour is Alejandro Valverde with 285 points. And with Samuel Sanchez's recent win, he's in second place with 173. In third place, Cadel Evans from Australia with 162 points. Fourth, Andrei Kazechkin from Kazakhstan with 156 points. And then in fifth place, Alessandro Bayan with 155 points. Now, at this point, Alejandro Valverde has nothing to fear from anyone else on the Pro Tour. There simply are not enough points left for anyone to overtake him for first place. So Alejandro Valverde will be this year's Pro Tour champion. He is going to be skipping Paris Tours, but he will be racing at the Giro di Lombardia to basically enjoy the ride and enjoy the party. So congratulations to Alejandro Valverde. It's been a topsy-turvy season, and he certainly does deserve to be the champion this year. Speaking of high-profile racers who've had a topsy-turvy season, Floyd Landis finally had his hip surgery last week. The 2-hour operation was performed last Wednesday in San Diego, California, and was, according to all reports, a complete success. Floyd returned to his home last Thursday and was reportedly going to begin physical therapy immediately to strengthen his hip and to increase his range of movement. He's expected to be back on his bike within a few weeks, and he's hoping to be able to compete again by the next cycling season, assuming he will be allowed to do so. According to reports, the doctors found more damage to Floyd's hip than they originally anticipated, but there should be no complications from the surgery. So we wish Floyd a very speedy recovery and hope he's back on the roads of Rancho Murrieta real soon. And from hip replacement to frame replacement, Cervelo and the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission recently announced a recall of about 650 Cervelo carbon fiber bikes and frames. The frames in question are the 2005 R2.5 models with serial numbers higher than R251700. The frames have clear coat over the carbon fiber and feature either red and white or blue and white Cervelo decals on the seat, head, and down tubes. Authorized Cervelo retailers nationwide sold frames, sets, and bicycles with these frames from December 2004 through May 2005. If you're looking for your model or serial numbers, they're printed on the frame tubes of the bike. And again, you're looking for a serial number higher than R251700. The danger, according to the warning, is that the frames can loosen or separate, causing an obvious danger of serious injury. I know that it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. If you have one of these bikes, stop riding it immediately and contact Cervelo to receive a free replacement frame. For more information, call Cervelo at 866-296-3137. That's 866-296-3137. Or visit either of the websites that I have put links to in the show notes. In more positive news, in the wake of the success of the inaugural Tour of California and the consistent success of the Tour of Georgia. NBC Sports and Red 5 Sports Group recently announced the creation of the inaugural U.S. Open Cycling Championships. This is a new race that's going to be run from historic Williamsburg to Richmond, Virginia on Saturday, April 7th, 2007. And this is going to be broadcast nationally on NBC Sports the same day from 2 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The event will feature both men's and women's professional races. Now, few details of the race have actually been released as of right now, but the promoters say that it will become what they call, quote, one of the cornerstones of American cycling and will attract top teams and athletes from around the world. Furthermore, they go on to say, the event will showcase the historic scenery and attractions of the state of Virginia just weeks before the 400th anniversary of America's first permanent English settlement in Jamestown, Virginia. Now let's think of this, folks. This means that we're going to have about 2.5 hours of coverage on NBC Sports, a major American network, on the same day the race is run. From what I've learned, this is going to be the first national network coverage of American road cycling event since 1996. The promoters are hoping that this is going to be a very successful event and that it could lead to its becoming the first Pro Tour event on U.S. soil. That would be fantastic. It seems to me that American cyclists are used to watching cycling delayed by several days, sometimes weeks, oftentimes cut to ribbons by editors in order to make it a little bit more exciting and more palatable for non-cycling sports fans. So to have cycling on the same day on a major American network is exciting, and let's hope that this becomes something that's extremely popular and that it's something that will continue. Now, I want to talk to you about a story that we talked about. I'll talk about it briefly here, but we talked about it on another podcast that I do that I've talked about here on the show, and that's the Spokesman Cycling Roundtable podcast. You can find that at www.the-spokesman.com. On the most recent show, we got together, and one of the stories we talked about was a new study, which was jointly funded by Monash University Accident Research Center and the Amy Gillette Foundation. This study looked at almost 14,000 bicycle to vehicle crashes between the years of 2000 and 2004. And what they found was that if you're a male cyclist and you're between the ages of 30 and 39, that you're at a high risk of being killed or injured in a collision with a motor vehicle if you're riding between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. on a weekday. That's a lot of you in this audience. So while I haven't had a chance to really go into exactly how they did the study, the results, I think, are important in that they should encourage you to use extra caution when you're out there on the roads, and something that we've talked about here on the Fredcast time after time after time, and the things that you can do to minimize your risk when you're out there on the road. But I think that the results are interesting. I think that they're highly believable. And if you want more information, go ahead and check out the Spokesman podcast. I'll put a link in the show notes. And of course, there's always one on the main page of thefredcast.com. Finally, in the same vein, I'm pleased to announce that Florida, like several other states in the United States that we've talked about recently, has recently enacted a new law, and it went into effect last Sunday, that says that motorists have to give cyclists at least a 3-foot gap while passing. Now, this is a big deal because the former law only said that they had to, quote, pass safely when they were going past a cyclist. Now they have to give them a 3-foot gap. And if they don't give them a 3-foot clearance, law enforcement officers could give them a moving violation and they could be subject to a fine and points assessed against their driver's license. In my opinion, sometimes laws like this are more style than they are substance, especially if law enforcement doesn't actually take it seriously and if they don't actually enforce the law. If law enforcement officers do go out there and they do enforce the law and they give a few tickets, it'll end up being in the newspapers and on the news, and it hopefully will have an effect on other drivers of motor vehicles who will think twice before, you know, it happens, before getting within inches or even millimeters of you when you're out there riding. So let's hope that this keeps all of us a little bit safer on the road, but keep in mind that, of course, it doesn't relieve us of our responsibility to ride safely and defensively when we're out there on the roads and highways. And I know some of you hate it when I say it, but it also means stopping at stop signs and stoplights and obeying the rules of the road. Because quite frankly, folks, a little longer time to finish your ride is always preferable to the possibility of not coming home to your wives and husbands and mothers and fathers and kids, don't you think? And that's going to do it for the news for this episode of the Fredcast for the week of October the 2nd, 2006. So just a couple of announcements I want to make before we get into our features. And of course, our features this week are the last of my interviews from the 2006 Interbike Expo. First of all, I want to let you know that there will not be a Fredcast next week. That's the week of October the 9th. I am taking 1 week off because after Interbike and after this coming weekend, which I'll tell you about in a moment, I am just simply not going to have the energy and the time to do a Fredcast. So forgive me, 1 week off, and then, of course, we'll be back the following week. So what am I doing this weekend? Well, I've talked about it several times on the show before. This weekend is the MS-150 Beta Bay Bike Tour, which goes from Irvine, California down to Mission Bay. It's a two-day event. I'll be doing a century on day one and then about 50 miles on day two. I'm bringing it up because I want to thank all of the Fredcast listeners who have donated to the cause. I really appreciate it. Thanks to you, well, you Fredcast listeners have brought in over $1,000 in donations in the fight against multiple sclerosis. I really appreciate it. And in the next Fredcast, in 2 weeks, I will be running down the names of all of you who donated, and it is very, very much appreciated. So thank you very much. Now, if any of you are in Southern California, and if you are participating in the event, I'm going to be very easy to find. I'm going to be on Saturday in a jersey that reads Team Landsharks. I will be wearing a gold number 6 with my name on it on the back of my jersey. And then, of course, on Saturday night, because I'm the chairman of the event, I will be speaking at the overnight event. If you're a Fredcast listener and you're also participating, please seek me out. I would love to meet you, and I thank you all for your donations and for those of you that are participating, for participating and helping to find the cause and cure of multiple sclerosis. So without further ado, I want to give you the remainder of my interviews from Interbike 2006. There are just a few of them today, and I'm pretty much just going to run them all together. They're all pretty much self-explanatory. Where it needs explanation, I will pop in and let you know. It's going to start off first with my interview with the folks from Orbea. Orbea, as you know, is the Spanish bicycle company that has really exploded on the scene here in the United States with their very innovative designs and their very innovative bicycles. I told you that I rode the Orbea Orca at the outdoor demo, and I told you how much I loved it because I thought it was light and stiff and extremely comfortable. And I had a chance to talk not only to somebody from marketing, but also to two of the engineers and product designers from Spain. So here is the interview with the folks from Orbea. I hope you enjoy it. I'm in the Orbea booth here at Interbike, and you recall that on Tuesday I rode the Orca and told you all about the bike and how I felt that it was light, stiff, responsive, and comfortable. And so I've got a whole gaggle of people here, and I'm with Justin Slarks, who's in marketing for the company. Justin, introduce your colleagues.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to have these guys here. They're part of our engineering staff from Spain. Very young, very forward-thinking, progressive engineers that are thinking outside of the box and doing great things with engineering with us. First, I'd like to introduce Iñaki Argote from Spain, and then we'll talk with Miriam Bengochea.
So, Iñaki, I think I've mentioned everyone here that when I rode the bike, the first thing I noticed was how light it was. The next thing I noticed was how stiff it is, and I was really surprised that even with the stiffness, it was still very comfortable. Tell me a little bit about how you do that, how you went about designing this particular bike.
Okay, it's important to say that before we start the development of this frame, we do a lot of meetings with a lot of people to analyze the good and the things that could be improved in the old Orca. In that way, we have a lot of meetings with professional riders, with people who ride every day just for having fun, with dealers. So we have a lot of inputs, and after that we analyze all of them. In that way we see clearly that the people like the smoothness of the old Orca and they wanted to keep it. I mean, it was one input that everybody told us, please keep the smoothness and the riding feelings that you have in this orca. So here is the product. As well, we have to recognize another point that there were people that telling us that maybe they would prefer to be a little bit more stiff in the rear side and in the front side. So, I mean, we did it as well. I mean, we take it into account. But, I mean, the most important thing is that in this moment we are not just presenting one bike or one bike in five sizes. We are presenting five different bikes with the same shape. I mean, and that's important. It's the key point of this bike.
How does that work if you have different sizes, but you have different, almost slightly different designs in each of these sizes? Is that part of the size-specific nerve? Maybe, Miriam, you can tell me how that works. Because I noticed it says that on the bike, and it's got a unique shape to the tubing. And maybe you can explain to me what the size-specific nerve is and how you do this in so many different sizes.
Mm-hmm. Size-specific nerve means, as Iñaki has explained us, that we are presenting five different bicycles. That means that we have worked size by size in terms of engineering optimization, in terms of design, size by size. This is a hard work, and I mean it's traditionally way of designing, coming from the aluminium technology and philosophy. The unique engineering variables were maybe the length of the tube, maybe the wall thickness, and that leads to problems of not balanced mechanical properties all along the sizes. That was something that we wanted to avoid. I mean, we wanted 500% well-balanced bicycles, and the only way to go over that is working with the SSN technology. That means that we have optimized one size, and what it works for a medium size in terms of materials, in terms of manufacturing, in terms of layups, in terms of tube sections, width of the tubes, for sure will not match the same specifications in a bigger size, where also the rider weighs more, and the frame, the bicycle, will need other kind of things. So size by size, we have make the 3D drawing, make the final element analyzing, choose the materials, manufacture a prototype, carbon prototype. We are able to manufacture carbon prototypes in our Orbea facilities in Spain. After the prototype and optimizing also the manufacturing process, which is always important, testing and then check if the outputs match the inputs in terms of engineering, in terms of weight, stiffness, design, those of things. If it doesn't work, then we start again. One size, two sizes, five sizes. This is a hard work, as I have told before, but it's more than a technology. It's a way of working inside of Orbea, and I think that this makes absolutely the difference between other brands. And how we have started this project, as Iñaki has explained, talking very close with our final customers. They are using our bicycles, they are buying our bicycles. We work for them, but in this way we work with them also. And this is very, very important.
So with you've got all these customers, and I know that you've spoken with racers, you've spoken with recreational riders. When it comes to the Orca specifically, Justin, what kind of a rider would you say this bike is made for? Because I could tell when I rode it, I could see a sprinter wanting a bike like this. I could see a century rider wanting a bike like this. Is this really the bike for every high-end rider? Who are you focusing on when it comes to this bike?
Well, I think we're going after what we would call the connoisseurs. The people are looking for the ultimate in ride quality. It's very stiff and yet very comfortable. Most of our professional teams will be outfitted with Opal for this coming year, which is the stiffest bike that we have. But that ride quality isn't for everybody. That's for the guy that's looking for the most efficient energy transmission, most sprinting capability. But ultimately, those guys, you know, they're a whole different breed, as we know. So the Orca itself is very much a refined ride quality, a customer that's a connoisseur.
I think Orca and Opal are giving the answer to two different kind of final customers. Both are high-performance bicycles. One, in this case the Orca, we have priorized in that high performance the smoothness on the riding. And in the Opal, we have priorized the stiffness, the speed, also in that level of high performance. And that leads to two completely different designs, as you can check. Also, something very important inside Orbea is our warranty policy. We are giving whole life warranty to all of our bicycles and in our carbon frames to really feel comfortable with the final with the whole life warranty. We think that only the monocoque can make us feel comfortable in that way. Of course, you can find lighter frames in the market. But it's always important to be careful with that kind of things and check the warranty policies. Eh? Anyway, I think we have one of the lightest monocoque frames in the market. Only the carbon piece you can see in that bicycle, in the Orca, in a medium size, only the carbon structure weighs about 735 grams. It's very, very, very light. We also have included absolutely integrated in the design some metallic parts like metallic dropouts, metallic cable guides bonded to the frame, seat clamp perfectly integrated, matching perfect the design of the frame and integrated in the frame. I think we have balanced very well in that bicycle, design in terms of engineering and design in terms of formal design. Complete.
So it's an impressive design. It's an impressive ride. You have an impressive warranty. Iñaki, can you tell me a little bit about how the company got to this point, where it started, and how it's grown, and where it's come from?
The history of the company, Orbea is a really old brand, I mean, but it has more than 150 years. But at the beginning, it wasn't a bicycle company. It was a gun company. So we weren't alive, but our ancestors, I mean, they were making guns, and it belongs to the Orbea family, this company. After to the Basque Country, because the company is situated in the Basque Country, there were industrial problems. The crisis arrives, so there was no money to continue making guns. But all the machinery that it was in the company was useful to make tubes. So we reconverted, or our ancestor reconverted all the company, and the machines that before were using to make guns start making bicycles. The 1960s, all the employees buy the company. So Orbea nowadays is a cooperative. I mean, the company belongs to the workers, to the employees, to the people who is working on it. And it makes a big difference to another one. I mean, everybody is the owner, everybody is in charge, everybody is involved in the working, everybody loves the bikes. I mean, so in that way, I think that is really nice, no? Because everybody who is working on it put their best every day, because it's the owner, it's part of a group. The relationship inside the company, I have to say, that are really close and good.
I want to thank all three of you. It's been very informative about not just the bike itself, but about the company. And I think that the fact that it is a cooperative, it is an employee-owned company, it shows in the work that you're doing. So thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I should mention at this point that every one of the people that I interviewed at Interbike has links in the show notes so that you can go to their websites and find out more information about the products that they discussed. Next up, I walked down the aisle and met with Craig Harrison, who's in marketing at Michelin. We talked about some of their existing tires and some of their new tires and which tires might be right for you.
And we're looking at road tires. Craig, I see a lot of my favorite tires here, the Pro 2 Race and a bunch of other ones. What are we looking at here as far as tires that maybe aren't changing for 2007?
Well, the flagship tire, which is the Pro 2 Race, isn't changing at all. It still comes in a variety of colors and comes in sizes from 20 to 25, 650s and 700Cs. Dual compound, it's a 127 TPI, very supple casing. We've had a lot of riders that have switched over from tubulars to ride these because the feel is so much similar. It's a very supple ride, very good grip with the dual compound, and very, very, very good rolling efficiency. It's, you know, it's the tire choice for most of the really serious racers that we deal with.
What about people who aren't racers who are looking at low rolling resistance? But they want something that also has good puncture resistance and good durability. Is this the tire for them, or is there something else that you recommend?
Well, that's probably not the tire for them. If there's a racer who's more worried about durability and longevity of a tire, the Kryolion Carbon, which used to just be called the Carbon, which just won an award from Road Bike Review as the best clincher tire, we're pretty happy about that. That is a tire that has five casing plies underneath the tread. It has four plies that overlap, and then it has a crown ply that goes right in between those plies, and then it has a super durable carbon compound. That and the Pro 2 Race and the Pro 2 Grip and the Pro 2 Lite are all they're all smooth treads, because our engineers tell us, and we've got some information to back this up, that the size of a contact patch on a bicycle tire, especially on a road tire, and the shape of it means that you'd have to be going 120 miles an hour to hydroplane.
You know, one of the things that I always thought was that it was the tread that was the most important.
That's really not important at all on a road tire, because there's so much pressure is being put on that small contact patch that it's really a matter of surface area. And the compound, how sticky that compound is, that and the surface that it's trying to adhere to. In some areas of the country, the tarmac is very smooth. In some areas, it's very rough. And the microstructure of the macadam has a lot to do with that. But it's really more of a function of air pressure, how much the tire deflects, the casing suppleness, and the tread compound itself, how sticky that is.
Tell me about the new tires for this year. What's coming out new for roadies?
Okay. The real thing that we're really excited about right now is the Lithion. Now, the Lithion came out last year, but this year we've expanded the Lithion to include all the same color schemes as the Pro 2 Race. It's 90% of Pro 2 Race in terms of the testing results we've got on in terms of its performance, in terms of its efficiency, its weight, its suppleness, its grip, its tread mileage, its puncture resistance. It's 90% of a Pro 2 Race, but it's only 60% of the cost.
In order to get the cost savings, though, is there an added weight to the tire?
Slight, 20 grams.
So overall, it's not a huge difference in the tire?
Not a huge difference. It looks a lot like a Pro 2 Race. The main differences are that the casing's a little more durable. It's a 60 TPI casing, a 60 TPI woven casing. It's not quite as supple, but it's still very supple. Whereas the Pro 2 Race uses our special ESC, which stands for extra supple casing. It uses our 127 TPI non-woven, very thin thread, very high density casing material. Whereas the Lithion uses a woven 60 TPI casing material. So it's the threads are bigger, and there's less of them per inch. So it's a little bit not quite as supple a ride.
So can you differentiate between the Lithion and the Pro 2 Race? Who might be the right audience for each?
A Lithion, for 90% of people racing or just riding or training, the Lithion is a great choice. And a lot of people will just use a Lithion as their training tire and use a condition-specific tire for their race tire. Like, they might use a Pro 2 Lite for a lot of their road racing, because it's the lightest tire we've got. But they'd use a Pro 2 grip for criteriums or for foul weather because it's the grippiest tire we've got. And then you can use, you know, you use your Lithion for training or for training races, things like that. A lot of people will use something like this on their training tire, or they'll use the carbon, the Krylon carbon on their training tire, and then on their training wheels, and then they'll just switch over to their race wheels to for whatever the conditions dictate.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Craig. Appreciate you being on the show.
Anytime. Glad to help.
And, of course, what would a visit to Interbike and a Fredcast be without talking to yet another gadget company? And this one is one that we've talked about several times on the Fredcast. It's Garmin. And I took a little bit of a different twist with it this time by speaking with one of the founders of Motion Based, which is a website that I've talked to you about before. So we'll move forward with my interview with Clark Weber, who is actually one of the founders of Motion Based. And what's really cool is that Clark is also a Fredcast listener. So hi, Clark. Hope you enjoy your interview.
Tell me a little bit about why you founded Motion Based, what the thought process was behind it, and where Motion Based is going in the future.
Yeah, sure. I've been doing web development for about 15 years out in the Bay Area. I've gone through the whole .com boom and bust, and one of my co-founders was a developer, and I was the product manager, and I got him a GPS device as a gift for getting a product out on time, and he took it out and just for a hike, and he thought, you know, this is cool. It tells me what where I am in the world, but he said the value is actually what it's telling me where I've been and all that data. So that was in 2000, and he said someday we'll start a company doing, you know, GPS analysis. And then 2 years later, he approached me, and he had a prototype built, and we kind of looked at it, and it was pretty raw. And I came in, and we decided to go from there. And at that time, it was still really large Garmin GPS devices, like the size of a brick. And we went to a couple trade shows, and we saw Garmin, and then they had the very first Forerunner, which was the wrist device. And it was small enough where finally we were like, okay, we can really start a business. So we started in 2003, and here we are today, now part of Garmin.
Now, for people who maybe, God forbid, haven't seen Motion Based before, describe to them what it does and what they'll see on their computer and how it interacts with their GPS.
Sure. What Motion Based is essentially, it's a web service, or we like to call it a web application because it's that powerful. What you do is it takes raw data collected by a GPS device, and now the GPS devices can be worn on your wrist or on a bike with the Garmin Edge. And essentially what we do is we try to make sense out of a lot of complex data, and we try to tell you exactly where you were, how long your activity was. We'll map it out for you. We'll break it down into graphs, and we store it all online, so it's really easy for you to share that data with your friends or if you have a coach, whatever it may be. The premise of Motion Based is trying to make working out and training, whether it's running or biking, just a lot more fun. And using Google Earth and Google Maps and stuff like that, we think we found that little sweet spot.
One of the things that we were talking about before we went on mic was the fact that what's great about Motion Based is that it's not just for PC users, that Mac users are also able to upload even from their Edge to Motion Based. Tell me about how that's going and where it's going in the future.
Sure, yeah. We we've been hearing from the Mac community for about a good year and a half when Motion Based came on the scene, and people didn't quite understand why this is a web service, yet it doesn't work on a Mac. And part of it is that we're doing a lot of complex stuff, a lot of hardcore development that was still using kind of Windows technology in the background. Garmin, in January of 2006, made a commitment to the Mac community saying we're going to support it. So it was easy for Motion Based, as it being a web service, to kind of take that first. So we had the ability to do uploads starting in March of 2006. So you can upload your data through a Mac with the Garmin Edge and the Forerunner. And there's still a few features, like our map player and the analyzer, that aren't available yet on Safari for the Mac. But we've made the commitment that it's going to be up live before the end of this year. So that's good. And then on the client side front, with the Garmin Training Center, they're trying really hard right now, shooting for December of 06, but I think realistically we're looking January of 2007.
And that date's significant because I understand from what you told me earlier, you've committed to being at Macworld, yep. And if you're going to be at Macworld, that means
Yeah, we have to be. We have to have a product out in January. I mean, the reality is that we made the announcement saying that it was going to be done in 06. So Garmin needs to stand behind that. So I promise.
Okay, you heard it here. We got his promise on tape. Clark, thanks so much, and good luck here at the show.
All right, thank you so much.
Now, I've gotten emails from several of you asking me about where you can learn to become a bicycle mechanic, where you can learn to actually build your own bicycle. And so I thought, hey, I'm at the show. This is my perfect opportunity to get a great interview with the folks from United Bicycle Institute. And here's what I learned. I'm with Ron Sutphin from United Bicycle Institute, all the way down here in Las Vegas from Oregon. And one of the things that you do, besides training mechanics for shops, is you also will train consumers in a variety of different things, starting with bicycle mechanics. Tell me a little bit about that course, who it's geared toward, and the kind of customers that will come up and take that class.
Our advanced class really is structured for a high-end enthusiast who wants to be self-sufficient. They sometimes are disappointed with the service at their local bike shop. Sometimes the quality of work, but more often it's the turnaround time for a repair. And just the desire to be self-sufficient out on the road, long rides, tours, things like that. So probably the average age or demographic for that class is 50, sometimes even higher on the class. So we get a lot of retired professionals who have super high-end bikes that just really want to know more about them and be confident in their abilities to keep going down the road.
And how long is that class? What do you teach them in broad overview? And what does it cost?
The class is roughly $600. It's Monday through Friday from 8 to 5. We have a couple optional open shop sessions on Tuesday and Thursday nights. We extend the day a couple hours until 7 o'clock. And the emphasis in this class is really to get people to be comfortable with their own bike, or bikes if they bring more than one. We want them to leave with the knowledge of what repair parts, if any, they should carry, what tools they should carry, so they really know how to set up their bike. And we try to make sure they leave with basic knowledge for buying replacement parts at a bike shop. So they know their hub widths, their tire sizes, their headset stack heights, their gearing capacity requirements, all of these details which seem kind of complicated, but they're actually pretty simple. And we just start real easy, removing wheels, fixing flat tires, and then we jump right into doing bearing overhauls and getting into fixing the drivetrain and pretty much cover every aspect of the bike.
Some of those things you talked about, bearing overhauls, for instance, you need some special tools to do things like that. What sort of arrangements do you have so that not only they're using the right tools in the classroom, but when they get home, they can make sure that they have the right tools?
Well, we have a really well-equipped facility, so people get to use a variety of tools. Sometimes you have your pretty good choice, different companies, different qualities of tools. And one of the things that all of our students leave with is a one-time only opportunity to purchase from United Bicycle Tool Supply, who wholesales only to bike shops. But the exception is to all the UBI graduates, they have a chance to make a one-time purchase at wholesale, and there's no sales tax in Oregon, so it's a pretty good deal. We spent some significant shop time talking about setting up your toolkit for your bike and how to outfit your home repair station.
Okay, so now you know how to repair your bike. What if you want to build a bike? I understand that you also have a program where you teach people, you actually help them build their own bike in your shop. Tell me about that class, how long it is, and really what happens there. And does somebody have to know how to weld before they get there?
Well, we have three different two-week frame building classes. So by 2 weeks, it's Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. Sometimes the days are a little longer, but typically 8 to 5. The classes are structured more or less the same. We have a two-week brazing class where people can fillet braze or do a classic lugged style construction. We have a two-week steel TIG welding class where we use chromoly tubing. And then we also offer a titanium class. And the classes are all formatted roughly the same, where the first 3 or 4 days involve learning bike design basics, building your welding skills or your brazing skills. There's no prerequisites. If you have experience, that's great, but people shouldn't be afraid if they've never welded before. That's what we spend a few days doing, and then just go through the process step by step, and you leave with a bike that you designed and built.
So you mentioned a bunch of materials. You didn't mention carbon fiber. You didn't mention aluminum. Is it something you're thinking about doing in the future? And if not, is there a reason why?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people in all of our classes, mechanics and frame building, sometimes they want to draw us out, like what's the best material. And I look at materials as just having different mechanical properties, and to take advantage of their positives and compensate for their negatives. The dimensions of the bike tubes change a little bit from material to material. And with that said, we really like steel. We really like titanium. We like aluminum and carbon fiber, but it's problematic to teach in a class. Aluminum has to be heat treated, and that's just a logistic issue to try to take care of that process after people leave and then ship them the bikes. Our feeling is if they learn how to TIG weld, they can make the adaptation to the other materials pretty easily. With carbon fiber, it really is an equipment issue as well. To do it properly, I hate to use that word, but I think to take full advantage of carbon fiber, you want to go with a monocoque construction. And that requires sophisticated equipment, and it's just too much to take on in a two-week course. We've toyed with the idea of offering Columbus makes a tube kit called Meccano, and it basically is a kit where you cut the tubes and glue it together. It's almost too easy. I suppose we could offer it as a one-week course, and we've toyed with the idea, but so far we've kind of stuck with the steel and titanium.
Excellent. Appreciate your time. Thanks for making the time for the Fredcast.
Very happy to do it.
I have to be honest with you, that is something that I would really like to do, which is build my own bike. So put that on my list of things to do before I die. Go up to Oregon and visit UBI. Now, my next interview is with a company that many of you have asked me to talk to, and so I'm glad that I had a chance, and that's SRAM. Now, obviously, Shimano and Campy have new components and new products out for 2007, but it seemed to me that it was more important to get a good interview with SRAM at this show, because this is the first time in a very long time that we've had a third choice when it comes to road components. And with the new Force Group, really a technological advantage, some new features that we've never seen before, I thought that it was important to do this interview, and I hope that you learn something from it and that you enjoy it.
I'm in the SRAM booth. I am with Michael Zellman, and that's SRAM's road PR manager, and we're talking about the Force components, something I talked about on the show 2 days ago, and components that I rode, which I was ready not to like, but I fell in love with, and that I was telling Michael earlier that I found to be real intuitive when it came to shifting. And Michael told me his definition of intuitive, and thought we might talk a little bit about the idea behind the components, the philosophy, and maybe you could tell us a little bit more about how they work.
Well, one of the things you mentioned earlier, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you on behalf of SRAM, but one of the ideas behind the group in terms of learning, I want to get back to the first thing you mentioned, and that was transitioning from another group. We want people to be skeptical, and we understand that, and that's why we're out to prove, you know, through all the various activities, our commitment to the road, whether it be cross, which we have an extremely heavy commitment to this year, whether it be the Pro Tour, where we'll be next year in the Tour de France, or whether it be with KodakGallery.com, Sierra Nevada, Team Orbea, Team Victory, these kind of things. We are really, you know, with our NRS crew, the neutral race support that travel over 100 events, we're committed to the road. Nonetheless, back to the topic at hand, we consider the SRAM Force Road Group to be the easiest group to transition to from another group. It has only one lever, the double tap shift lever. And so you said the word intuitive, and I've always understood the word intuitive to mean something you just understood from birth. And while it may not be truly intuitive, from a road rider's perspective, it is intuitive because it just makes sense. It's one lever, you push a certain distance, you know, you push it perhaps a quarter inch, I'm not exactly sure what the measure is on that. You push it a short distance, you actuate one shift. You push it a further distance, you actuate you know, a downshift. So it is intuitive. It's as simple as it possibly can be. So transitioning from other groups, Campagnolo or Shimano, it's going to be the easiest transition. Where you're going to have trouble is going back to your old group. I promise you that. I've done it, and I've talked to about 100 people that try to do it. You're going to, if you spend any significant time, a week or more, on the SRAM group, you're going to have a little bit of, you're going to make more misshifts on your group than you will ever on the SRAM group transitioning from it. Also, if you've never ridden a road bike before, the SRAM Force and Rival road groups are going to be those easiest to learn.
One of the things when I was out at the outdoor demo, a gentleman pulled up next to me. He was testing a road bike the same time I was. And he said to me, how do you like these shifters and the fact that you can sort of pull them in toward the bars and you can still shift with them? And my comment to him was, well, if you think about it, it's a lot like grip shift. Because if you're down in the drops, you can twist just like you would with grip shift. Was that part of the thinking behind it?
Well, the original thinking behind the road group was best in class. That was the first philosophy they came up with. But yeah, absolutely. What it's called is a SRAM sprint shift. We have a rider, Ben-Jacques Mains. Ben-Jacques Mains rides for KodakGallery.com, Sierra Nevada. And he did some testing at an SRM mounted on his bike. He mounted his bike with all the other component groups, you know, one at a time. He did shifts with Shimano's Dura-Ace. Shimano's Dura-Ace, fantastic road group, no question about it. Innovative, brings a lot to the table. But between every shift, he lost 400 watts of power. He measured it. He did it over and over again. He lost 400 watts of power. The strength of the actuation of the SRAM Double Tap, he only lost 40 watts. 40 watts of power versus 400 watts of power. How many miles an hour that translates to, I have no idea, but I'm telling you this, it will make a good sprinter much better, and it'll make a bad sprinter good. So in other words, that's an advantage. Yeah, absolutely. You can bring that lever to the bar, you can grip the bar firmly, and you can actuate shifts very quickly. Not only that, I hate to keep dwelling on this point, but you come out of the final turn, and sprinters know this, they come out in a lower gear than they typically want to. They're cranking it out, trying to bring that gear around because they know they only have one or two shifts, and they're going to lose a lot of speed in between those shifts to get it up. With the SRAM Force group, because of the positive actuation, you can have it a higher gear. You can start at a 15. You don't have to start at the 13. Start at the 15, go to 14, go to 12, you know, go to 11. And you can fire off shifts, and you're going to lose 40 watts of power. You know, that's insignificant in the overall scheme.
And one of the things you said was you wanted it to be first in class. Talked a lot about the shifters. I'm sure you've got a lot of other features that make it first in class.
Yeah, we've got a lot of features. It was no holds barred. We said, you know, in terms of materials, function, ergonomics, and weight. And pricing obviously falls in there as well. But really, ergonomics, function, materials, and weight were all the things we paid attention to. And paid attention to heavily. This group was not forced out, you know, in other words, when it was ready to go, that's when we launched it. It seems like, you know, it was a bit late compared to some of the other launches, or a bit early, however you want to look at it. Actually, it was a bit late. But that's because we wanted to make sure everything was right. We worked with our customers, and they understood our timelines, and the bikes are spec'd here. You walk around, you're going to see almost 90 brands worldwide specking SRAM Road. For a first-year product, that's unheard of. And so a lot of the momentum taken from some of our other, you know, our mountain bike products, SRAM, Truvative, Avid, RockShox, that momentum's brought its, you know, brought its energy to the road and really helped us along. But the road, you know, has proven itself in the short term it's been out.
Other than the shifters, any other specific components you want to focus on?
You know, it's really a balance. The shifters are the brains. The brains of the operation, obviously. Without shifters, you just have components. And so other companies are announcing the fact that they're going to have a component group. I know FSA has been talking about a component group, but that's fantastic. I'd love to see their shifters. You can talk about a rear derailleur, you can talk about a front trailer, you can talk about brakes all day. They're not that complex. They really aren't. They're basic mechanisms. There's a lot of complexities within them, but understanding them is, you know, most companies can do that. Most companies can create those from scratch. That's why there's a number of companies that can do that. But to create the whole grupo, there's only two, and now we're the third.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, and good luck with the new group.
Hey, thanks a lot. Have a good one, and hope people will definitely make the leap and consider the SRAM Force Road Group moving into 07. Okay? Thanks.
And finally, for those of you who are tired of aching legs as you're climbing that last climb of the day, or when you're getting to the end of your century or the end of your double century, I found a product that is just for you and that is completely legal for racing, whether it's in the United States or abroad. The product is called Sport Legs.
I'm in the Sport Legs booth, and I'm talking to Gail Dolliger, and we've been talking about their product, Sport Legs. All right, you got to start all over again because you're so good. Tell me what you just told me about the product. Tell me what it does, what's in it, why somebody would want to use it.
Certainly. Well, Sport Legs is the best thing to come along since sliced bread, in my opinion. Basically, you never have to have sore muscles ever again, and I can't really imagine anything cooler than that. It's a pre-sports vitamin. It is all natural. You take it an hour before you do any kind of exercise. The immediate benefits are that it's going to allow you to last a lot longer before you get fatigued. You won't notice a muscle burn near as quickly, but best of all, you won't get sore afterwards. You won't get stiff. It gets rid of cramps, all that.
Okay, this is amazing. How do you do it? What's in it?
Well, there's really only three ingredients in it. Again, it's all natural. We have calcium lactate, magnesium lactate, and vitamin D in a vegetarian capsule. So when you take Sport Legs an hour before exercise, what we're doing is putting lactates into your bloodstream to help your body balance its production and consumption levels of lactate so you don't accumulate so much lactic acid. It does have the calcium and the magnesium, which also benefits the bone strengthening. It's a more absorbable form of calcium and magnesium. Most calcium comes from a shell source, and it's very hard for your body to break down and digest. When the calcium is in a lactate form, it can move right through the muscle walls. It lowers the acidity of the muscle, so again, preventing the lactic acid buildup, or it will neutralize it if it's already there. So the nice thing about Sport Legs is if you forget to take it ahead of time, you go out and have a great time, you come home, you wake up the next morning and you're already sore, you can take it after the fact. You notice in about a half hour, 40 minutes, your sore muscles just simply go away.
Okay, so there's a hill that I like to ride every day, and by the time I get to the top of that hill, I'm dying. Is this going to help me?
Absolutely. Let's take, for example, you're out on a road ride and say that you have a climb that normally takes you about 16 minutes to get to the top. And about the last 3 or 4 minutes of that climb, you're really suffering and you're looking at the top, just, you know, counting the seconds till you're up there. When you take Sport Legs, it's like having a good day in a bottle. Not only are you going to get up that hill faster, you might climb that hill in about 13 or 14 minutes this time, but also about 30 seconds after you crest the hill, you're going to notice that you're already recovered and you're going to feel like you're ready to do it again. So you get the strength benefit and the increased, I should say decreased recovery time so that you're able to go out and do it again and again and again.
Okay, so now I'm out on a ride. I'm doing a century. Mm-hmm. And I took it an hour before I went riding. I felt really great. Do I take it again during the ride?
It depends on how long you're out there. For most people, a century does last more than 2 to 3 hours. So in a race situation, you really want to redose every 2 hours. If you're out there riding, hiking, playing, usually every about 3 hours is sufficient. You can kind of listen to your body. I like to take it an hour ahead of time. And then if you start to get that feeling like, wow, I'm really starting to work hard here, this is getting a lot more difficult, that's a sign that you need to take more.
And listening to it, I mean, it sounds like a wonder drug almost. Is it legal? Will USA Cycling be okay with riders using it if they're racing?
Yes, absolutely. It abides by all the regulations and rules for USADA, for IOC, basically any competitive organization that's out there. With the three ingredients being the calcium lactate, magnesium lactate, and vitamin D, there's really nothing to be banned. It's not like a steroid. You're not going to pump your body up and exceed your limits or be putting extra stress on your joints. What we're really doing is preventing a waste product from forming in the first place. So, you know, there's a lot of other products out there that claim to help with lactic acid, and what they're really doing is helping your body deal with the lactic acid after it's already formed. We're preventing it from forming in the first place. We have a lot of endurance athletes, the 24-hour athletes, the adventure racers, you know, people that are going for multiple days at a time. They're taking Sport Legs every 2 to 3 hours for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 days in a row, and that's fine. There's really no problem with overdosing. The other thing that they're finding is that they need a lot less food while they're out there. Their body is working so much more efficiently without the waste product of the lactic acid that they're actually needing less food, less water, and when you're competing in something like an adventure race, all that stuff really adds up.
Where do people find out about the product? Where do they buy it?
The best place to look is at our website, sportlegs.com. You can find a local retailer. We have a list of all our retail stores there. You, of course, can always order it online. And we have a number of online retailers as well, and those will be listed on the website.
Great, thank you. And one last question. Tell everybody why they recognize the name and who you are.
My name is Gail Dallagher. I've raced professional downhill and mountain cross bikes for a number of years. I'm a two-time U.S. national team member. I believe I'm the second woman in the world to pull a backflip on a mountain bike. And I do a lot of just coaching and PR work.
Well, good to talk to you, and good luck here at the show.
All right, thank you so much.
And that's going to do it for my coverage for the 2006 Interbike Expo. It was a blast. It was incredibly tiring, and I'm hoping that you enjoyed every one of the interviews that we did. I made a lot of contacts there. I've got a lot of new products coming to me to test, so you're going to reap the benefits over the next couple of weeks and months. And hopefully some of those contacts are going to turn into product giveaways and lots of product reviews and good things in the future for the Fredcast. So hopefully that's going to be something that you'll see in the future. Now, after I left Interbike, I headed out to the Portable Media and Podcast Expo in Ontario, California on Friday and Saturday. Learned a lot about podcasting, learned a lot about podcast promotion, met a lot of podcasters and people that you know. Leo Laporte, Callie Lewis from Geek Brief TV, Dawn and Drew, the Manic Mommies, Charlie and Carol from Israelisms, just every podcaster you can think of that has a name I met there, including the famous Jeremy Vaught from Triathlon Radio and the Beginner Triathlete podcast. So it was a great time, learned a lot, and again, something else that you Fredcast listeners are going to benefit from that I learned about at the Podcast and Portable Media Expo, including the fact that this is the first podcast that I'm actually recording using the Audacity software instead of using GarageBand. And hopefully that means I'll have fewer hiccups and fewer problems with the show. So thank you very much, everyone, for all of your support and also for understanding the fact that I will not be here next week. Before I go, I do want to remind you to please go to Podcast Alley. It's a brand new month, and vote for the Fredcast. There's a link in the show notes, and there's also a link right on the left-hand side of the homepage at thefredcast.com. I'd also like to urge you to please spread the word and to take a line from my friends at the Manic Mommies. Tell three friends this week about the Fredcast and get them listening. And if you don't have time to do that, go to iTunes and write a review about the show. Some of you have asked why these things are important. Well, they're important because they help build the audience. Building the audience is what's going to help keep us getting noticed by companies in the cycling industry who will be willing to send us products to review and who will be willing to do interviews like the ones that you've just heard over the last week or so. So please do spread the word. There's lots of ways to contact us, and as you can tell, lots of people do. The easiest way, of course, is to send us an email, and you can either send us a text email or you can insert an audio comment. And our email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. Of course, you can visit our website at www.thefredcast.com. You can send us a voicemail at 206-203-FRED. And of course, if you just want to send an audio comment, there is a link on the show notes on the webpage at www.thefredcast.com where you can click a button, use the microphone on your computer, and the audio comment will be sent right to me. Again tonight, no PodSafe cycling music. I'm just going to give you the end of Jimmy Bratcher's Happy. I hope you enjoy the music. I hope you've enjoyed the shows and all of the interviews. But over the next week and a half while I'm gone, most importantly, enjoy the ride.